Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Azadeh Mashiri from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the dramatic series of pager explosions across Lebanon. As security experts scramble to piece together the paper trail, armed group Hezbollah firmly believe Israel are responsible and say they intend to retaliate. So what's next? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Bees. And in a moment, the climate may have been a lot hotter in the deep past than it is today, but that's no reason to be complacent, according to the paleoclimatologists who do the hard work of mining the details.
Our curve demonstrates that the average Earth temperature was quite a bit warmer than today, but that's all from natural events that happen at a slower rate. And so, again, the main point is what's happening now is at so much faster rate than what we've seen in the geologic record.
The fantastic global temperature history of life coming up. Also, remarkable new insights into the teenage years of our ancestors in the last ice age.
There's a lot of concern in modern kind of society that teenagers are developing much more quickly than they did in the past. But from the work we've done, both looking at these Upper Paleolithic teenagers, but also medieval teenagers, they all seem to be entering, starting puberty around the same age.
That's all to come. We're starting with flooding. Not the astonishing flooding in Central Europe from Storm Boris, we may come back to that and the connection to global warming next week, but flooding in, of all places, the Sahara. This vast desert in North Africa exists because of global atmospheric circulation patterns. But every now and then, storm systems can break into the dry zone, sometimes dramatically, as has been happening in recent weeks. The details of Saharan weather are hard to grasp because it's so empty. There's only one rain gauge per 200,000 square kilometres, climate scientist Moshe Armon told me. That's like having one measurement for the whole of the UK. But Moshe recently compiled a history of flooding in the region using satellite measurements, and he says the recent events truly stand out.
3 weeks ago, we saw rains in the eastern side of the Sahara, and floods in Sudan, which also brought to the collapse of a dam near Port Sudan. But since then, we are seeing this heavy rainfall moving towards the west through Chad, Niger, then Mali and Mauritania. And this is something that happened in the last maybe two and a half weeks. So all the southern part of the Sahara got wet because of this rain event.
But this was a really striking amount of rain as well, is that right?
Yes, that's correct. I've heard estimates for the heaviest rainfall in northern Chad for the past 40 years or so. But, I mean, that could be still just a few tens of millimeters because that's a really dry area. But what's so special about this event is that these rains that went into the western side of the southern Sahara, this is something that we see every summer, but maybe this summer it got a little bit more to the north, into the drier part of the Sahara. And then what happened this year is that there was an extra tropical cyclone passing over the Atlantic next to Spain and France, and it drew some moisture from the precipitation that happened in the areas near Mali and Mauritania into the northwestern Sahara, so into regions which are almost totally dry normally.
So it sounds like the way you describe it, these are weather systems that are penetrating into the normally dry part of the Sahara, where there's generally a high pressure that keeps weather systems out. And they were drawing moisture in not just from the sea, but also from land just to the south.
Yes, that's correct. That's why this case is really interesting. I mean, it is a combination of an extratropical system with something we can call a tropical or maybe a subtropical system that brings rainfall normally into the southern part of the Sahara and the Sahel.
Can you give me a sense of the amount of rain? I mean, as you say, this is dry, so a year's rain may not be very much, but this is enough to cause, I think, in parts of Morocco, really substantial flooding and damage.
Yes, you're correct. We saw a lot of damages in Morocco and also Algeria. What happens there is that normally there is not a lot of rain. So every major event of at least a few tens of millimeters can cause huge floods and damages. And what we saw in Morocco and the western part of Algeria is that there was at least a few tens of millimeters, and some estimates show even 200 millimeters of rainfall over a short period of the 7th and 8th of September. We saw some more rainfall since then, on 12th of September, and even today. And tomorrow and the day after tomorrow, we are expecting some more rainfall in the area.
And so it's partly the persistence of this weather system somehow that's, for you, very interesting.
Yes, the persistence or the recurrence of it. I mean, it rains every time in the same location, meaning that the same streams would be flooded and therefore also the same locations would get damaged.
And you also mentioned flooding that started in Sudan. So this is on the east side of the Sahara, and then that moved across. Is that a separate story? Are they connected?
So it seems that they are connected to some extent, because there are these waves traveling over the southern part of the Sahara and the Sahel normally in summer. We call them the African easterly waves, in which precipitation is increased over the, let's call it, the heart of the wave. And this started in Sudan, and then it traveled westwards, West Africa, and then this moisture got drawn through this extratropical cyclone into the northwestern part of the Sahara. So in a sense, they are connected.
The general picture I get is that the pattern of the moist tropics, then the Sahel, and then the dry Sahara are because of sort of global circulation patterns that are the sort of general status. And it sounds like what's happening is the moisture is penetrating a bit further north than normal.
Yes, it penetrates much further north, and we saw these rains in Morocco and Algeria, but actually the same system brought rainfall later on to Italy and the Balkans, so countries around the Mediterranean, but on its northern side. So the moisture got withdrawn quite far away from its origins.
I suppose what I'm wondering is this just one of those things? Sometimes weather systems break down, other things happen. That's just the nature of weather. Or are you concerned at all that this represents the warming of the seas and changing circulation?
It's a difficult question to answer. We saw similar events in 2014 and I think also 2008, where a lot of precipitation hit the northwestern Sahara because of such an extratropical system that penetrates quite close into the tropics. But whether this pattern gets increased because of global warming or not, that's a question I can't really tell. What I can tell you is that because of the warming temperatures, whenever there is already a system like this one, can expect rainfall intensities to get higher and therefore also to produce more serious flash floods and so on, as we saw now in Morocco and Algeria.
The floods obviously are very damaging, but to what extent can they be offset by infrastructure if people know what to expect? And also, you know, is the water captured so that it can be used by people in the area? Because in such a dry area, every drop of water must be important.
Yes, that's correct. And we see quite a few dams that were built both in Morocco and in Algeria in order to capture this water. People use it for irrigation mainly, but also for the production of electricity. But that's quite an interesting topic because, for example, there was a dam that was built in Morocco and they based their assumption on why should we build a dam in Morocco in this area on just a few years of rainfall measurements in the area. In these years, we saw a lot of rainfall in Morocco and therefore they built a dam. But then after the dam was built, for more than a decade, it remained empty. It's really hard to estimate how much rainfall we actually have in the Sahara. We saw a similar thing, but maybe to the other direction in Derna, in Libya, exactly a year ago, where dams were built to protect the city from floods. But the floods were so severe that the dams collapsed, and we saw many casualties because of this. So the variability of rainfall in the desert is so high that it's really hard to estimate either trends from climate change, for example, or even what we should expect in a normal year.
It sounds like it's not just the time then, but also the place is so sporadic that some places could go dry for years on end and then suddenly have an absolute deluge.
Yes, that's correct. What is particularly interesting now is that this event happens, or rainfall happens, again and again over the same areas of the dry Atlas Mountains and the northwestern Sahara. So the same streams are getting flooded, and then also lakes in this area, lakes and reservoirs are getting filled because of the rain.
With this extreme rainfall in Morocco and so on, for example, is this going to reshape the landscape in the way that will be a trace of the event that happened? And is that a thing you can use to understand what happened in the past?
So to some extent, yes. And we can see flood layers within lakes or over dry streams when we dig the bottom floor of these streams and lakes. And then we can see some remnants of specific events. People have done that all over the world, including in the Sahara. And one thing that they say about the Sahara is that it used to be wetter a few thousand years ago.
They call it the Green Sahara, I think.
Exactly, yes, the Green Sahara. And in recent years, people are discussing paler Green Sahara. And the events that we see now and the remnants that they leave, maybe we can track them. Then we can say something, or we can learn from it about past climates in the Sahara.
Moshe Amon of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And a reminder that it's just a year since flash floods along the coast of Libya devastated the port city of Derna, which we talked about at length at the time here on Science in Action. You can still find those episodes at the programme webpage on bbcworldservice.com. Our archive there does stretch back decades.
I'm Azadeh Mashiri from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the dramatic series of pager explosions across Lebanon. As security experts scramble to piece together the paper trail, armed group Hezbollah firmly believe Israel are responsible and say they intend to retaliate. So what's next? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
As Moshe mentioned, the Sahara has been green, and world climate has had its ups and downs since the beginning of time. And if understanding current weather in the desert is hard with just a handful of rain gauges, unravelling the global climate of millions of years ago, when there were none, is truly a challenge. But geochemists are smart, and they can interpret chemical details in the composition of, say, old shelly marine organisms for clues of what happened in those deep past years. And an international team of experts have just constructed a temperature history covering most of the period of complex life, the Phanerozoic eon, going back to 485 million years ago, and showing not just how variable climate can be, but also how tied it is to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Brian Huber told me the effort started when they decided to update their fossil hall at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History in Washington.
For the exhibit, there was an agreement that we needed to present the history of climate through time. And the main thing is the preservation of the fossils is sufficient to get reliable temperature information back to about 110 million years ago. But as you go back further in time, the sources of temperature data become fewer and fewer as you go back in time. And we pretty quickly realize that, boy, we need some help to sort of build this out further back. And so it was really the first time that a workshop like this was convened to build a more reliable temperature curve for the history of the Earth in the last 500 million years.
I mean, I think the thing which is so striking is that the planet has changed so much in that time. Continents have come and gone. Mountain ranges have come and gone. The poles have been changed. But also, the nature of the life has changed so much. It seems to me actually extraordinary that you can find any kind of record that's sort of sufficiently reliable that you can really say, yeah, I think we've got it now.
Yeah. Well, you're so right, and I think one of the things that's in our favor is, first, the ability to use chemistry to make estimates of PCO2 or past carbon dioxide changes, as well as past temperature changes. The kinds of chemical analyses, the quality of data has just improved through time.
These are sort of chemical watermarks in the fossils or the rocks that you find, is it, essentially?
Yeah, for example, I work on microscopic fossils called foraminifera. And these things produce a shell, like clams produce a shell, and it's calcite, calcium carbonate. In the calcium carbonate shell is an isotope of oxygen called oxygen 18 and another isotope called oxygen 16. Now, the ratio of the heavier isotope to the lighter isotope is directly proportional to the temperature of the ocean when the shell is mineralized. Now, the foraminifera have two kinds, one that floats, so they live up close to the surface of the ocean, and another kind that makes a shell on the seafloor. And so from every sample I look at with my colleague's mass spectrometer, we can analyze the oxygen isotope ratios and get an estimate of temperatures.
The sort of the ups and downs of temperature going back nearly 500 million years. Well, I found them really quite striking. And I think you're saying in your paper that they're actually quite a lot bigger than had been previously thought.
Yeah, the dynamic range of temperature change is greater in our new temperature curve. And compared to any previous temperature curve that's been estimated for the Phanerozoic era, we do have quite sharper shifts and a larger range in shifts. And overall, the average temperature of Earth is warmer than previously estimated.
When you say warmer, you know, how much warmer than today?
Today, the global mean temperature estimate for surface temperatures is on the order of 59 degrees.
Can you do that in centigrade, Celsius?
Yeah, 15 degrees centigrade. So that's today's current temperature average.
And at its peak, up in 30 degrees?
The peak is 36 degrees average. And the coldest is 11 degrees centigrade. Prior to that, I think the average was probably on the order of the mid-20s.
So those hottest periods really have been much hotter than we've appreciated in the past, you're saying?
Yes, particularly the Cretaceous greenhouse. The tropical temperature estimates are on the order of 42 degrees centigrade, which really brings to question, you know, how can life exist with those kind of temperatures? The paper discusses that, and part of what is important for understanding this is seasonality and did it stay that way year-round? Based on what we know, it did not. But nonetheless, there are assumptions about what life can tolerate and whether or not evolution can change to have sort of a narrower comfort zone or be able to tolerate more extreme temperatures. And that's something that's very hard to prove other than just the fossil record. You know, did these fossils exist at these temperatures in places where these temperatures were so high?
Those past temperatures, of course, were reached over geological times, I guess, when evolution was able to adapt to some extent. Today, of course, we're facing global warming, which is incredibly fast, I presume, compared to anything that you've seen in the record. And it's being driven by carbon dioxide. I was just wondering, does carbon dioxide play a big part of the story in the history you're looking at?
Yeah, no question. Our paper shows there's a strong correlation between the estimates of CO2 through the same time interval as the temperature curve.
So that goes up and down as well?
Yes, indeed. And the correlation is strong throughout the Phanerozoic.
But the general picture of the carbon dioxide level being the crank that controls the temperature is borne out through those studies and your own.
Yeah, and exactly. And so what we know from these detailed studies is that, you know, the CO2 is triggering the warming event. The warming event can last a very long time before temperatures return to the pre-event kind of temperatures.
I mean, just to stick to that sort of theme, all the time I see climate deniers saying that, oh, well, temperatures used to be way warmer than they are today, as if that's some form of comfort. And you're saying, no, that's no comfort at all.
Yeah, exactly. There's no question. I mean, nobody would argue that we've had warmer temperatures in the past. And our curve demonstrates that the average Earth temperature was quite a bit warmer than today. But that's all from natural events that happen at a slower rate. And so, again, the main point is what's happening now is at so much faster rate than what we've seen in the geologic record. This is really driving climate change at a faster pace than these events, these hyperthermal events that have happened before.
Brian Huber, one of the team who've just compiled the Fantastic, that's Fan with a PH, as in Phanerozoic, Global Temperature History in the journal Science. The past 2 million years have been some of the coldest in the Phanerozoic, subject to a sequence of ice ages interspersed by short interludes with rather more congenial conditions like the past 10,000 years in which civilization arose. These briefer ups and downs are what shaped our human evolution. And an archaeological study in the Journal of Human Evolution has just taken a look at what puberty was like for our ancestors towards the end of the last ice age, the Upper Paleolithic, up to 30,000 years ago. After much searching, they came across 13 promising human remains, near complete skeletons that could tell a biological story, coming from Italy, Czechia, and from Russia. But with techniques they'd already proven from more recent digs, Mary Lewis told me that was enough to start their investigation.
We've tried this method on a much larger group of individuals from the medieval period. So I had over 600 individuals that we tried the method on originally. We wanted to see if we could apply this method to really early humans from the Upper Pal. So these individuals date from the 10 to 30,000 years ago.
I mean, what sort of details is it in the bones that helps you construct a story?
There are various sections of the skeleton, areas of the skeleton that we look at, that in modern medicine they have been associated with different stages of puberty or the growth spurt. And these are areas such as the development of your canine happens at a particular time around when you're starting to accelerate in your growth, in your growth spurt. There's things like fusion of your bones in your wrist, the bones in your elbow, and changes in the shape of the bones of your neck. So they go from being quite flat, the bones in your neck, to being kind of curved over. And that happens as you grow and develop. And then the final bit that we look for is on the pelvis. There's a bit of bone that forms and fuses to the top of the ilium of your pelvis. And that happens right at the very end. So it appears, this bit of bone appears as girls have their menarche around 6 months before their first period or after their first period. So it's a really crucial bit of bone for us.
In a sense, it's comparing these details on the different skeletons that's enabled you to sort of say, OK, this is when they start to mature, to start to have their puberty and so on.
Yeah. Each one of these changes or fusion or development appears at different stages of the growth period. So we can trace them, which stage they're in, at what age they're in that stage in each individual, and then compare each individual to see the variability in development.
And you have enough detail to tell whether it's much the same as in modern society or very different?
I mean, I think our main findings was that the teenagers in the Upper Paleolithic were entering puberty around the same time as they do today. And I think one of the reasons this is interesting is that there's a lot of concern in modern kind of society that teenagers are developing much more quickly than they did in the past, and that puberty's starting much earlier. But from the work we've done, both looking at these Upper Paleolithic teenagers, but also medieval teenagers, they all seem to be starting puberty around the same age, between 10 and 13. And our Upper Pal teenagers, our Ice Age teenagers, were also entering puberty around that time. So it's around the same time as they are today, which is suggesting that there's some kind of genetic blueprint as to when we start adolescence and when we start this sexual maturation, and that it goes back, you know, 30,000 years.
I mean, in a sense, if you put these children in T-shirts and jeans and things, they would presumably be pretty much the same as they are today. But I guess the historical context is so different that, you know, this is a time of great hardship.
Yes, so they were really well-developed, our Ice Age teenagers. They had very well-developed muscles, and they were obviously contributing to their society in a very fundamental way. But they would have had a very different lifestyle to modern teenagers. My co-authors, April Noel and Jennifer French, have done lots of work on looking at teenagers in the Ice Age from a social point of view. And they're developing both cognitively as well as physically. But in comparison, like hunter-forager societies, teenagers grow up in a mixed age group, and they are exposed to adult life in a much more intimate way than our teenagers are today. And so the idea is that they're developing and they're ready for adulthood much earlier than teenagers are today. So this idea of teenaged angst, anxiety, not understanding your place in the world, being very self-conscious, isn't something that we see in other societies where communities are growing up very close to each other. So that's one of the things that makes them interesting. So they would look exactly the same as our teenagers today. Put them in a T-shirt and a pair of jeans, they're exactly the same.
But they didn't get to lie around so much, maybe.
No.
I mean, what's interesting is it sounds like the at least the ones you're looking at, their diet was good. Because I was imagining that maybe diets and how well fed a child would be would affect the age of maturation.
They would have had a much more natural diet than we do today, but there's no sign on their skeletons that they were particularly malnourished. They had quite a lot of fractures, the healed fractures, so they were living in a, you know, they were dealing with big animals and they were having quite a vigorous lifestyle, but there's no evidence that they were necessarily malnourished. However, having said that, they enter puberty at the same time as modern children today. They take a lot longer to get through puberty than children do today. And that is probably something to do with the level of nourishment that they get or the amount of physical exertion that they had to use to stay alive in their community. It takes a lot of energy to get through puberty and to grow during this kind of very turbulent growth period. So that might be why they're experiencing a delay. So they took about 4 to 5 years longer to reach full maturation compared to teenagers today.
That's very interesting. I mean, with these individuals, any sign that they died from injury or that they had diseases that took them away?
One of the individuals is thought to have died from, we think, from acute trauma. The suggestion is that he got attacked by a bear. He's got cut marks on his skeleton that suggest he died from an attack like that from a big animal. And he was actually, he's been considered to be a great warrior, but when we looked at him, he was still a child. He hadn't really entered puberty. And then we had probably the most remarkable skeleton I've ever looked at in my career, my 30-year career, an individual who's called Romito II from Italy and who had dwarfism. And he's our earliest known individual with dwarfism. And he was a very robust individual. He was obviously contributing to his society. I mean, the nicest thing about him is that he was right on the cusp of puberty. So he'd entered puberty and his voice had just started to break at the stage he was at. That's what was happening. And he was just starting to grow facial hair. So he'd have had a little fluffy moustache. So you can really start to picture these individuals as human beings in their own right.
That is really lovely that you do that. It sounds like you're ground truthing, as it were. You're testing out your approach to doing this kind of archaeology. Do you have ambitions to look much further afield than Italy and Europe?
These skeletons are very rare, but we would, of course, love to apply these methods to even earlier humans, potentially even Neanderthals. There's lots of speculation about sexual maturation in Neanderthals compared to Homo sapiens, so it'd be interesting to see if there is a difference and whether we can apply our methods. But we do need complete skeletons, so it's always a rarity. But yes, certainly, as more are discovered, we'd definitely want to continue exploring this really essential, fascinating period of human life.
Fascinating indeed. That was archaeologist Mary Lewis of Reading University. You can find a link to her study via the Science in Action webpage, which, as I said before, is at bbcworldservice.com. And that's where you can find me, Roland Pease, and producer Jonathan Blackwell next time. Or you can just tune in, traditional style, on your radio, if that's your preference.
I'm Azadeh Mashiri from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the dramatic series of pager explosions across Lebanon. As security experts scramble to piece together the paper trail, armed group Hezbollah firmly believe Israel are responsible and say they intend to retaliate. So what's next? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.